Thanks for listening to the History Buff podcast with your resident history buff and Berlin tour guide, Arty. If you're enjoying the podcast, then you can really, really help us by liking and sharing the episodes on social media and rating the podcast on your streaming platform. If you'd like to see more History Buff content, then please give us a follow on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. Links are in the show notes. Thank you for your support. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first discussion episode of the second season of The History Buff. I am joined today by Eliezer Colina, fellow history buff and a writer. He has a BA in political science with special interest in political theory, history, and economics. Yeah, and he's also Venezuelan, so he has a local knowledge of Latin American history and politics. Welcome, Eliezer. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Cool. So the topic that we're going to discuss today is something that I am really fascinated about, and that is of a project, I guess you could have called it, of Gran Colombia. So basically, in a nutshell, I guess what you could say, it was a political project that basically incorporated the lands of what is now Venezuela, Colombia, Ecuador, Panama, and a little bit of Peru and Brazil.
It wanted to add a little bit of Peru and Bolivia, and also Cuba and Spanish Haiti, today known as the Dominican Republic, were in tentative talks to join the union if it were to be successful.
If it had worked out, yes. Okay, and it only lasted from 1819 to 1830. Am I right?
Yeah. Cool. Barely a decade.
Yeah, exactly. So, cool. Well, I guess in order to understand this, we have to first go back to all the way back to the beginning of the century, when you basically had Napoleon's alliance with Spain. So do you want to introduce that topic to us?
Yes. Basically, at the late period of the 18th century, basically you got the Revolutionary War in America, and you also got the French Revolution. Two parallel events that coincided with the moment of overthrowing monarchies and things. So you got Napoleon rise to power. He gets in control of the European continent. His French armies are devastating Austria and all the other enemies that he encountered. So Spain had no other option being in the same geographical area to forge an alliance with Napoleon. It was a strong arm alliance, but it was beneficial to both of them since Spanish and French already had a lot of connections. So the thing that was that triggered the forming of the Revolutionary War in America was that the Spanish let the French army into their country to quell a rebellion and also to threaten Portugal, because Portugal was not trying to ally with Napoleon. But when the French enter and when Napoleon found out that the Spanish monarchy was really ineffective and corrupt, he basically decided, well, you're not going to be useful as an ally. So I'm going to dethrone the current Spanish king, and I'm going to assign my brother as the new Spanish king. Joseph Bonaparte. Then with the new usurper king, all the colonies were like, well, our previous king was already dethroned. The usurper king, are we going to follow him? And then basically there were, from the other side, there were a group of men, very specific revolutionary-minded men with liberal ideas that they got from Washington and the French and everyone else. And they said, well, we actually don't need a king, so we can do our own thing. So then the Revolutionary War in America was basically deciding, are we going to stay loyal to this king, or are we going to become independent republics?
Yeah. And the thing that fascinates me is that Spain, the Spanish Empire, it was, you know, one of the biggest empires the world has ever seen, you know, ruled over pretty much most of South America, South and Central America, and also obviously North America as well. Yeah. By the early 1800s, as you say, it's very corrupt.
Yes. It's very like fragmented. And the previous century, the Spanish Armada was kind of like a fear. Something to be reckoned with. The armies of Spain were fairly good at what they did, but then the fractures of the system started to really come down at the late 18th century, beginning of the 19th century.
Yes, and you had power vested in the hands of the prime minister at the time. I believe his name was Godoy.
Yes.
And it's more to remember at that point, Napoleon is trying to cut off Britain with his, what's it called?
Yes, his trade embargo, basically.
His continental system, I think.
His continental system, the trade embargo that was trying to isolate Britain at the time. It was the ultimate war that he was going to invade Britain if he could, but he couldn't manage to consolidate the continent.
Exactly. So, I mean, I guess this leads us nicely into the next topic, because obviously, yeah, you have the weakening of authority in Madrid. And this impresses on someone who would come to be very pivotal. And would you like to introduce him?
Yes. Basically, the main character of the story of Gran Colombia and of the story of the Spanish independence, the Revolutionary War in America was...
From Spain, yeah.
From Spain, basically, was Simón Bolívar. He was the main character that proposed this project. He's the main ideological force that unites all these countries to form Gran Colombia. And it was basically his idea, instilled by a bunch of influences on him, that he wanted to have a free America, but also like a powerful America, like a Latin American continental power, basically to counterbalance the US in some way.
Right. He actually comes from a very rich family. His father was, I believe, a merchant or some very rich colonial administrator.
Yes, he was basically a colonial administrator, merchant. He had some sort of trade deals back in Caracas. He was so aristocratic that his actual name is kind of like, I can say the full name is Simón José Antonio de la Santísima Trinidad Bolívar Ponte y Palacios Blanco.
Wow.
That's all the last names combined. He was so aristocratic, and he was the marriage of two powerful families. Obviously, the Bolívar's and the Palacios Blanco was his mother's family. So he was kind of like in the prime position to do that.
Okay. But basically, he's born in Caracas, but he has a very sad childhood, doesn't he? Because his parents die whilst he's very young. And then he's sent to go and live. He and his brothers are sent to live with his grandfather, but his grandfather then dies very shortly after.
Yes.
And then he's sent to go and live with his uncles, who he hates, and he goes to then go and hang out with the sort of poorer people in Caracas, doesn't he? And this really has an effect on him.
Yes.
Well, I mean, I guess that is a nice sort of intro to Simón Bolívar. So he gets all this military experience from a very young age, and then he manages to secure Venezuelan independence. So do you want to talk to us briefly about that?
Yes. To talk about that, I think we need to refer to Bolívar's main mentor. I think he would be basically his Aristotle to Bolívar's Alexander the Great. That will be Francisco Miranda. He was the main teacher that taught him how to be military strategist. He also kind of like induced him into the liberal thinking. They were both Freemasons. So Miranda was basically the guy who set them in his way to be successful. Miranda itself couldn't actually secure the Venezuelan independence, but Bolívar actually managed to do it after a lot of attempts. There were like two or three republics that were overthrown by the royalist army. But then in the end, he managed to actually secure the independence of Venezuela by the late, I think, 1814. And he basically got political control over the region, but Venezuela was not yet independent. That's what he actually started the revolutionary march towards Colombia. And then he went down to Peru and then to what is now Bolivia and Ecuador.
So what do you think are the key ideals and visions that Bolívar had for Gran Colombia when he was thinking about it at this stage?
Okay. He had two major trends that he wanted to send. Do you have the theoretical or ideological front? Is that he was basically this instructed individual in the ways of literature. He believed in free men and the right of basically self-governance. So his idea was, when we are the Americans, so we are the Latin Americans, so we ought to govern ourselves. And we are brothers, in a sense, Venezuelans, Colombians, and Ecuadorians and Peruvians. So we were basically just brothers in the same continent. So we ought to join together and become like a power And he looked at, obviously, to the U.S. as an inspiration of a newborn American power. He wanted to do the same thing in the lower hemisphere, in the southern hemisphere, to be a power. That was his ideal. And then we had the practical sense that is also related, that is, he wanted to create a political union, a powerful country that could rival the Empire of Brazil, that was also gaining strong force within the continent. And he also wanted to basically rival the other vice kingdoms that Spain used to have, like, for example, Mexico, and the Rio de la Plata, which is currently Argentina. So there was he wanted to be basically the middle. In the middle, he wanted to build a strong empire that could rival all of those three other axes of power, Brazil, mm-hmm. Argentina, and Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so he basically manages to form Gran Colombia in 1819. And as we said at the beginning, incorporated what was New Granada. And I think it was known as the Viceroyalty of Venezuela.
No. Nueva Granada was a vice kingdom. It was the, let's say, the lesser vice kingdom of all of them. And then you got the general captaincy of Venezuela. That's it was an other province. It was a captaincy. And Ecuador wasn't yet didn't exist yet. It was the southern provinces of Nueva Granada. That was Guayaquil. That was Ecuador at the time. But Ecuador itself didn't exist as an independent thing. And Peru was combined with Bolivia at the time.
Uh-huh, exactly. And so, but it's decided basically between the elites in these nations for Gran Colombia, and Bolivar installs his generals as presidents in some of these countries. And I guess one could argue major mistakes that Bolivar made is that he tried to make it far too centralized. Is that right?
Yes. The main dichotomy of the Gran Colombian project was between Federalist and centralist. Bolivar was a centralist. He saw the figure of the great leaders. He basically tried to mirror similar aspects of Napoleon, that he wanted to be like the president, but it was basically a dictatorship, because it was a lifelong presidency that he could actually just choose his successor. So some of his generals said, well, this is basically a monarchy, so we traded a monarch for another. And the Federalists were all his generals. Each one of them wanted to rule their own piece of land and wanted, let's join to the international sphere. We're going to be together. But within our national borders, we're going to do our separate thing. And each one of us is going to have our own presidents and our own political systems. And they wanted to do more like a federal system, like with Venezuela, Colombia, and Ecuador and Peru. All got to have their own presidents, but then when they come to international matters, they could be like a joint together force and army, like a common, like the 13 colonies, a common army, a common identity, but as separate federal entities that could actually be more easily governed by their own leaders.
Yes. Another mistake that he makes, and something that pisses off his homeland, is the fact that he chooses Bogota as the capital. And so after this, the elites in these other countries obviously are pissed off. And so this leads to the Constitutional Convention of 1821. So they come together, and do they write a constitution, or does he basically write one and present it to them?
Yes, they did actually wrote a constitution, but the input was like 90% Bolivar, 10% everyone else.
Right.
So he started the Constitutional Convention just to give you like a spirit of something. Like the quote that he gives, one of the parts of his speech said as following: only in a profound respect of the sovereign will would obligate me to submit to the formidable weight of the supremacy magistracy. The gratitude owed to the representatives of the people also imposes on me the pleasant obligation of continuing my service to defend with my goods, with my blood, and even with my honor, this constitution, which embodies the rights of the brotherly peoples bound together by liberty, goodness, and glory. That's what's his.
It's very reminiscent of the American Constitution.
It's very, very reminiscent, big, because he was taught to, he was also a writer, and Miranda was acquaintance with Washington. So he told him about the American Constitution, and he said something similar. We are together as brother, together we're going to bound, this, you know, we are bound by the will of the independent people, of the free people, to make this project work. And then he, all the representatives couldn't oppose Bolivar. Even his best generals couldn't say no to him, basically.
I mean, I've had a look at the constitution and of Gran Colombia. And to be honest, to me, for the time, it seems like quite a progressive constitution. You know, it included representation, individual rights, citizenship. And I think it also then does, I think, specify federalism.
Yes, that's the thing. Bolivar and his ideals, his speeches and his intent was to be a progressive, free man with rights of man. Everyone gets a representation, fair hearing, and federalism. That was the idea that he was taught. But then it existed the political reality of him wanted to unite all of them. And that's where it got to, like a difference between his ideal and the reality. And the, in reality, Bolivar was more authoritarian than what his writings would suggest.
And he said to the people assembled at the Constitutional Assembly, basically take it or leave it.
Yes, basically. And even his best generals, like for example, Páez, even Páez had a lot of military power, but even he couldn't rival Bolivar's image and political capital at the time. So he just had to basically bend the knee and says, well, yes, let's going to try it your way for now. And that's important that the most of the generals said, let's try it. But behind each other's back, when they were drinking coffee or whatever, they said, just for now, let's let him do this thing now.
Yeah. And how do you think Bolivar, he navigated the tension between centralism and federalism in the political structure of Gran Colombia, or do you think he didn't?
I think that he basically didn't. I think he was ideally, like I said, more inclined to federalism because that was his main inspiration. But in reality, his methods and or his practices were more military. In basically, there were hierarchy. You do as I say. I'm the general. You have to obey me. That's the structure. And then he, in reality, he tried to apply a very militaristic, hierarchical way of rule. And that's what communication started to break down because to be an effective military leader, you have to have direct and basically connection with your subordinates, meaning that they have to be connected to you and the hierarchy has to work. But the problem is that the hierarchy was not working. And there was a major disconnect between what Bolivar said in Bogota and what people in Caracas wanted to do, or people in Quito wanted to do, or people in Bolivia or Peru wanted to do. So Bolivar could say from Bogota, you will do this. And by the time that the horse came with the message and the letter exclaiming, what are we going to do? Basically, everything had happened. For example, Sucre, one of his basically a lifelong friend and also a general, Sucre basically separated Bolivia from Peru and gave them independence. But then after that, Bolivar chastised him because he didn't actually want him to do that. But then Sucre said, well, that was you, what you told me. What I thought that you wanted me to do was to liberate Bolivia and gave them independence. But Bolivar actually later said, no, I wanted to join the Gran Colombia project. And there was a discussion between that, but it was a delay and misunderstanding in the orders that also happened. And that happened throughout the whole Gran Colombia project. There was a major disconnect between Bogota and Nueva Granada, and then all the provinces were kind of like doing their own thing because the infrastructure wasn't there to relay information. So each local leader had to basically do what the best that they could with the semblance of a constitution that Bolivar said, but there was
saying to them, you have to work together now. But, you know, they had actually been managed separately for a very long time.
So each aristocracy didn't want to, like, merge. So the merchant class in Caracas aristocracy wasn't nearly as joined with the Quito aristocracy or the Guayaquil or the Peruvians. They didn't want to do that. They all had their own political structures. They all had their own empires. Well, not empires. Like, they all had their own businesses to run, their own lands to run, their own history. And that basically to be told that you're, for example, it's like somebody told you today that you have to coordinate with your third degree cousin from your mother's side. And then you have to work with him to establish a political system. And then you don't even know each other. you live too far away, there is no way, then that's where the problems start.
Yeah, exactly. I also wanted to talk a little bit about what was the situation like in the territory of Gran Colombia at the time? What was like the social and economic situation? Was it good? Because obviously these sorts of things are the things that really contribute to, you know, discontent among the population and things. You know, was Bolivar trying to do good things like, you know, with the economy, land reform, slavery, social inequality, or any of that stuff? Was any of that, you know, having a good effect?
There is two major issues. We have just come from an independence war, which to some scholars, they think that the revolutionary Spanish independence war is mostly a civil war. So that left a lot of social fractures within the countries because it was brother against brother, cousin against cousin. And we were raised together, but now we need to kill each other because you're a royalist and I'm a freedom fighter. So that caused a lot of...
Because some people were royalists, you know, and they wanted to stay part of Spain.
Yes, they didn't want to be a part of this new, like, at the time, heretical project of independence. And I say heretical with an intent because most of the society was Christian Catholic. So by disobeying your king, you're basically disobeying the will of God in a way. For example, in Caracas, there was an earthquake. I think in 1811, there was the earthquake. And some of the priests and the bishop said that it was a God-given sign that the revolution was a mistake, that we should have stayed with Spain. And same things happen in all the other countries. At the major economical upheaval of having brother against brother, burned lands. And remember, at this point, most of the economy is agriculture. But then you have the same differences. Brother against brother, businesses go down, everything is burned. We're trying to rebuild a society, but also we have this really underbelly, this underbelly of slavery and class conflict. The Spanish were much more discriminatory in the classification of individuals. For example, you were Spanish from Spain, it was very different, and you were being discriminated if you tried to mingle with the Spanish who were born in America, even though they were both Spanish and maybe in the same Caucasian. The place where they were born make them different. And even some authors, like, for example, there's an author that I like who wrote a book. His name is, like, the name of the book is From the Good Savage to the Good Revolutionary by a Venezuelan journalist. And the main thesis of the book is that because of the being of the good savage, that, you know, the Rousseauian good savage, the main thesis of the book is that in Latin America, we never actually got over the structures of the slavery mindset.
Right.
The author of the book is Carlos Rangel. And his main thesis is that we have ingrained in us this slave owner and slaver mentality, meaning that we still had the dichotomy of people working the fields, and we wanted to implement this progressive society of free men, but we actually didn't have a populace for it. A lot of people were either hyper aristocratic with a lot of power and a lot of money, and there was the lower class. And the lower class had a complete disconnection. The slaves and the serfs and the mixed race people had a complete disconnection with the elite's idea of what the country should be. So we have a social disconnection from the major populace. The economics is not there because when there is a war, an upheaval, businesses don't run. And then we have this slavery mindset that doesn't allow people to be free owning business owners or free working men.
Exactly. So basically, this means that Gran Colombia is essentially doomed from the beginning because the foundations are so rotten. Basically, the rotten leftovers of Spanish imperialism means that Gran Colombia's foundations are very weak.
Yes, basically that means that the whole political project is held together by Bolivar's will and charisma. And the problem with that is that the moment that he's not there, or he goes on a trip, or he gets sick, or whatever, all the cards on this house of cards start to tumble because it is just held together by his political ambitions and will and basically charisma to convince others to follow him. Mm. But in the reality, when the check comes, when you have to pay, when the economics are not there, the people are not there, and the leaders are not there, everyone started to notice that the spell of Bolivar's ambition was starting to fade away. And then the reality was that, okay, this is not working. We need to do our own thing. We need to separate, or else we're going to collapse and we're just not going to function.
Right. What was each constituent country's vision for Gran Colombia? Because they probably all had competing visions for it, didn't they?
Yes. Basically, the major players, obviously, Venezuela, Colombia, and Ecuador. First, Ecuador, I think it wanted to be independent. Ecuador had a lot of distinctions with Bogota, and the I think it was called the Royal Assembly of Quito, was a distinct political entity for a while. So they were aiming to be independent from Colombia. The Ecuadorians, they weren't Ecuadorians at the time, but they wanted to be independent. So the idea of joining was basically forced out of them, because they actually just wanted, hey, thanks, Bolivar, but we actually wanted just to be our own little piece of land. Eventually they were, but at the time they couldn't do it. So they actually didn't want to be the capital. They just wanted to be their own thing. And then you got the major discrepancy. Venezuela, like I said, had the most generals in the war, had main fighting force of Bolivar was from Venezuela, and most of its generals are. So all of them wanted Caracas to be the capital. But Venezuela was one of the weaker constituency, so they didn't have a lot of economic power. Even though they had the military ambition and power, Caracas was, even though it was fairly good logistically as a capital, because it's in the middle of the mountain and it's well guarded, it was directly near the coastline. So it was very highly likely to be invaded. If the Spanish were to send the armada, they could just arrive at the shores and then go up the mountain and invade Caracas. Mm-hmm. That would have put the project in jeopardy. And then Bogota in Nueva Granada basically also wanted to be its own thing, but it could have been content with being the capital, but they actually didn't want to basically carry the burden of also trying to help Ecuador and Venezuela.
Because it so was the even from most dominant, it was the economically most dominant, right?
Yeah, it was the economically most dominant of the three. So basically, Colombia was left with the bill, and they said, well, I don't want to pay for them. I don't want to help them get on their own feet, because I already have my own issues. I got my own money. So I could be governed myself as an independent, but you're asking me to take basically my two little brothers and basically just try to raise them to my level. And right. that's instead of raising all of us together to be good economically, most of the Colombians just thought that we're going to sink together. We're trying to handle this and pay for this. It's going to basically put us in a lot of debt, which they were right. So each nation at the end of the Gran Colombia was gifted a huge amount of debt because of Bolivar's intent as a political union. Oh. So none of them actually really looked back on it like with a lot of warmth or anything. They actually right. see it as like a really strifeful period.
Okay, so, I mean, I guess that leads us on nicely to the disillusion of Gran Colombia. So I guess you could say, yeah, the causes were, yeah, no infrastructure, no communication between the capitals, you know, well, also no communication really between the sort of people of the regions, you know, and then through that, disagreements over the structure of the state, federalism versus centralism, and also the people from these different constituent states, Colombia, Venezuela, Ecuador, but also Panama, a bit of Peru and a bit of Brazil, didn't feel Gran Colombian.
They didn't feel Gran Colombian at all, because they were separate, and they were kind of like the alliance of the lesser provinces of the Spanish colonies, but they actually didn't look at each other like very brotherly as in the constitution stated. And if you factor in the idea that it wanted to be mostly a political economic bloc, when you tried to add Cuba and Haiti, or Spanish Haiti, what is now the Dominican Republic, Santo Domingo, to the equation, you realize that there is not a lot of cultural connection. There is not like a path. There's no joint there's no joint sense of identity. That's one of the major things. There was not like a grand Colombian identity form. Mm-hmm. and it didn't have any time to form because it was just like a 10-year thing, and it was at the end of the major process that was the colonies. So each of them didn't have the impetus to actually become one with each other. So each of them just started to basically do their own thing, even though Bolivar explicitly told them not to do that. Each of them, even though they were browbeaten by Bolivar's ideals, their reality was overwhelming. Each of them could only handle their own land, their own, even within their own land, they couldn't handle everything that was happening.
Right. And so, yes, that basically means that by 1930, it's all over. So reality caught up with the legality. And so, yes, each country goes their own way. Did it happen? Did the dissolution happen in a messy way, or was it fairly peaceful? And did it just sort of dissolve into the night?
At the end of the Gran Colombian dissolution, it was kind of like both, but it was both in, like I said, in the real sense and in the legal sense. In the legal sense, it died like with a whimper. It was like an act that was signed, and the current stated president was kind of like, just sign this, we're over. Legally, it was kind of like a whimper. Like it died, basically. The reality is militarily and politically, it was very chaotic. It was like, we're here. And then, for example, Bolivar, you have to understand that at the beginning of the project, Bolivar was very optimistic. He had a good attitude. He was willing to work with people. But each year, he started to accrue more power. He grew more dictatorial. He was hardened. He was getting more and more obsessed with power. And even his generals and friends told him, you're going down a path of, you're going to alienate all of us. And you're going to end up in a without friends. And none of us are going to back you up when the time comes. And lo and behold, the time did actually came, where Bolivar's charisma was basically on the floor. And his former best allies and friends and generals were basically saying, you're off the rails. You're going ambitious. You're ambitious for power. Has led you astray. So I am not going to listen to you anymore. I respect you. Thank you for helping us with the revolution. But now I had to basically put a stop to you for you do more damage. That was one of the things that, for example, Pais, one of his the major generals of the war, actually had to talk to him. And even at the time, Bolivar, with his ambitions, he couldn't argue against Pais.
Pais was also the head of Venezuela, wasn't he?
Yes, Pais, Jose Antonio Pais, was the best general in the Independence War, and he was the representative of the Venezuelan idea. He was, a little brief about his history. He was born basically lower money. He was like a lower class aristocrat. He wasn't aristocratic at all, sorry. He was a lower class white. And then he started to get really good at the military thing. And he got a couple of victories, and then he actually had the military tactic prowess to actually do a lot of maneuvering around the Spanish armies. And he got the respect of the mostly fighting force of Venezuela. It's called Lanceros. It was a specialized army unit, which in its own way, a kind of a history of what he did. But then he just basically took the baton of the Venezuelan leadership. He was saying, well, I'm unofficially the representative of Venezuela as his most prevalent military leader. And then he actually became the first presidency after his conspiracy to separate Venezuela was successful. And it was a conspiracy in just the term, because it was explicit. He just said it, and he said it to Bolivar to his face. And then he actually just did it. He separated Venezuela and became the first president. He served like 3 terms after that. And he was really involved in the idea of Venezuelan nationalism, because he was obviously being in the war and fighting and having a lot of military experience. He said, well, we granted ourselves our independence, so we ought to handle this ourselves. Uh-huh. So we need to join. We are we. And then you got from the other side, you have Santander. Santander is also one of the major generals of the Independence War, but he's Colombian. He's from Bogota. He's very similar to Bolivar. He was the son of an aristocrat, and he was also good at the military experience. And he was the vice president of Colombia. Explicitly, he had the title, But even he has his own reservations, and the New Granadan aristocratic class was whispering in his ear, hey, I know that Bolivar's your friend and that he helped us, but like, we don't want this to go on. We don't want to join with these other provinces. We want to do our own thing. Colombia is ours. So we trust you to basically do the same as Pius. You just tell Bolivar that this is not going to work, and that then he became the first Colombian president after the separation.
Okay. And so if you could put a date on when Gran Colombia dissolved, is there a specific date, or was it a sort of process?
Well, you can say that each of the countries has basically their own day.
Oh, when they declare independence.
Because basically when they declare independence, it was actually just, like I said, it died with a whimper at the end. So it was legally dead, I think, in 1831, if I'm not mistaken. I think it died at that point, 1831.
Right.
That's when Ecuador and Colombia, Ecuador and Venezuela decide to leave Gran Colombia. They send the declaration and then it's over. But you can just, like I said, you can face the reality that there was never really an effective Gran Colombia. So they were just putting pen to paper, we're separated, we're over, even though, like, for example, like a marriage, the wife has been living out of the house for 10 years, and then she finally signs the divorce papers. That was kind of like the example. So for politically, they were separated for a long time, even before legally they were.
Right. So I guess what you could say is this failed political pet project of Bolivar, it's partly because, well, a lot because his ego got in the way. But then also, would you say it's because obviously the caste system that was implemented by the Spanish. So as we said, as we were talking about earlier, these rotten foundations that were left by decolonialization, well, that had been left by colonialization, and then when the Spanish had left, that they had left behind, meant that Gran Colombia never really had a chance.
Yes, I would say basically, and you can see it, just to put out a specific date on it, it was on October 20th, 1831, that New Granada as a republic was established, and like I said, Santander was the first presidency. But then you have the moment simply when it was a convention actually in April 31 with the general at the time, the vice president, I think was Rafael Urdaneta. He just surrenders to the other vice presidency, and then it's abolished on November 21, 1831. But like I said, it was putting a final nail in a coffin that was already 6 feet underground. They were already dead. So it wasn't like something that it could be done. So I think, to be honest, as a historian, I think that Gran Colombia never really had a shot. It was drew a lot of parallels to the, like, how do you call this? The Roman Empire. Like when you try to, the attempts to revive the Roman Empire after the fall. I think it was very similar historic when you have Frederick, I think. Redbeard Frederick, I think, where he was the Sacred Roman Empire. It was a similar parallel where the issue was just the leadership, but the economics wasn't there. The people weren't there. The national identity wasn't there.
All the ingredients needed to make a country successful, basically, were
success. They weren't there. And I think one of the major factors that we haven't mentioned is the military one. Basically, since Gran Colombia did not have a major enemy to fight, it didn't have the capacity to form a new identity around that enemy. Basically, they were just stuck fighting each other. They never actually left that mindset of the independence war, of civil war, brother against brother. So it just became nation against nation. It was Peru against Colombia, and then Peru against Ecuador, and Ecuador against Bolivia, and then Colombia against Venezuela, and Venezuela against Colombia. And then it left kind of like this mark on the continent that we still see today, even in places when you don't notice, like in football. Football, we are very, very tribal, very divided. We are very nationalistic in that sense. Yeah. So if we never manage to actually join and we never actually were forced to join. So we just remained with this everlasting rivalry between nations. So each wanted to outdo each other. Right. And like I said, the economics also wasn't there because of the agricultural system. Slavery-based labor market didn't allow people to work and to produce. And by not being productive, a lot of them became a burden. And by being a burden, the structures of the state couldn't work because there was no money, there were no taxes. So we needed to accrue a lot of debt to actually maintain this kind of like Gran Colombia project, was sustained by a lot of interest and debt. And at the end, each country just got, hey, we got to go our own way. And then each one had to accrue debt and just pay up all debt. And they'd get new debt in, new money to actually establish their own country after that experiment. So there wasn't a capacity to it. I think historically the factors weren't there. And also, like I said, the social factor, the hierarchical, aristocratic, and then peasant dynamic did not allow the common man to form an identity with Gran Colombia.
Yes, exactly.
So the Gran Colombia was mostly just something that the aristocracy, and even not even the aristocracy, was just Bolivar's idea, and he influenced people on it, but nobody was convinced about it.
Cool. Super interesting. All super interesting. I have two questions that I think we could probably finish up with. So the first is, what happened to Bolivar?
Okay. So like I said, Bolivar, like we have established before, he drew a lot of parallels with Napoleon. And just like Napoleon, he met very tragic and bitter end after being the dictator or the president of Gran Colombia, the freedom fighter to end all freedom fighters. He was actually called El Libertador. He was El Libertador. He was the figurehead of the independence. So after being that and having all the power, all the generals, having defeated the Spanish Empire and decolonized the Americas, like I said, he was on a downward spiral, personally and politically. He had burned all of the bridges that he had built with the alliances in Venezuela and Colombia and Ecuador. His business were basically unattended and got railed into the ground. So he didn't have any money. So he was borrowing money to try to survive. And then before he got the chance to basically exile himself, he just made a stop in a Colombian town and he got sick of tuberculosis and he basically died.
Whenabouts was this?
This was Bolivar's dead. It was around December 17 of 1830.
Straight after dissolution of Gran Colombia.
Straight after the factual dissolution, when Venezuela and Ecuador declared it, and the legal structure was still there. It was abolished a year later, but Bolivar also died before that. So he was dead December 17 of 1830 in Santa Marta, and he died basically in an impoverished state with a borrowed shirt, a borrowed horse, nothing to his name to really claim, no wife, no children. And his friend, Sucre, was dead. Páez was in Venezuela. Flores was in Ecuador. None of his major generals or friends or family was there. He was just simply attended by a local doctor, some strangers, and he died. And then he was buried. And even though he later, everyone, we're sorry that this happened, then his remains were returned back to Caracas after that. But it was like a really tragic sad death because he wanted to do more. He always aspired to create something great, and he actually kind of did, but not in the way he intended. So at the end, he kind of like just goes down basically as a broken or beaten man, having realized that even though he did a lot of liberating, he did everything that he could on that front, he couldn't manage to construct anything. He couldn't construct the structures that he wanted to. He could liberate people, that he was very good at it, but
is that he did. Ultimately, he's basically the man responsible for, you know, liberating vast swathes of northern South America from Spanish rule. And, you know, what's a shame is that he probably wanted the George Washington ending, where he, you know, became president and, you know, was a very great president, you know, printed on money and, you know, remembered in that way. But how is he remembered now in Colombia and Venezuela?
In Colombia and Venezuela, he's obviously now, after his tragic end, at the moment he was in the historical moment, he was unpopular because of his recent dictatorial tendencies. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of like his heel turn. I don't know if you know, in wrestling terms, he kind of like turned evil at the end. Mm-hmm. So that's why he died tragically. But then history kind of like pass on the wounds of the war, and then each country established itself. And then it says, well, we actually do have a George Washington figure. We do have a national hero, and Bolivar is the national hero for these poor Venezuelans and Colombians and Ecuadorians. He's the major historical figure for all of them. So he now is revered, and we have provinces named after him. Uh-huh. For example, in Venezuela, each town that is considered like a city has to have a Bolivar Square. And if it doesn't have a Bolivar Square, it's not considered like a major town. So each town has to have their own Bolivar Square. And his history is taught for kids in primary school, secondary school. We have historians, analysts about it, a lot of paintings. So at the end, even though in the moment he wasn't recognized like Washington, later down the line, he did actually got the grand treatment as the figure of history that he did want. He had the paintings. And then the coin, for example, in Venezuela, we use the Bolivar as a currency. Ah. So he's plastered all over the iconography and then the painting.
So he probably did get, ultimately, he probably did get the ranking that he wanted. It's just that his political project didn't survive.
Yes, it's basically he got the recognition that he wanted. But tragically, as history always happens, he got the recognition decades and centuries after his death. So he was later basically redeemed by the popular ideals, the country's national sentiments that actually revindicated most of what he said. And it's funny because he actually did predict some of the future. He did realize that by not forming Gran Colombia, we basically did trade one imperial power for another, in this case being the U.S. He will eventually be right that the U.S.
That's what his aim was to basically be the United States of the South.
Of Latin America or South America, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we got into the sphere of influences of the U.S. And right now he has gained, he's popular, the people of Colombia and the former states of Gran Colombia. But it's now, for historians, it's really tragic that he couldn't actually at the same time managed to consolidate that, because most of the peoples now realize that his vision was probably right, that we needed like a stronger united front. In the international sense and the economic sense, and the turmoil of not being that has left us kind of like historically stranded. So we are basically part of America, part of the greater New World project. But Latin America itself has never kind of like managed to raise to a developed state in a country.
Exactly.
There is one major book or movie I really like. It's not about Bolivar, it's about another figure that is called Bobis. He said this thing. At the end of the movie is called that, Taita Bobis, and he was another figure of the Independence War. He said, at the end of the movie, he dies by the will of his own people. He gets kind of like betrayed when he gets killed. And this man said something that I really resonate with. He says, I condemn all of you to be wandering time looking for a Taita. And that means I condemn all of you to eternally look for a leader that's never coming. And then you realize that most of the Latin American countries had that thing, that longing for a leader that Bolivar was. And then he's there like spiritually, but never politically materialized. Like, for example, the U.S. had Washington, Jefferson, and a lot of succession of great leaders. But even into the late, you got like, for example, Lincoln. Lincoln was kind of like the great consolidator of the U.S. after that. And we never got that figure. We had some presence. We had dictators. But we also get that this longing for a leader. And that's, you are reflected that each Latin American country is basically still with the mindset that they want a great leader, a great man of history to lead them to prosperity. And Bolivar saw that.
I guess Bolivar is that, but he just doesn't have, unfortunately, the political success of the United States.
Yes.
He's got that emotional factor, but he unfortunately just didn't, his political project, Gran Colombia, didn't get off the ground and all of that kind of stuff.
Didn't get off the ground, so he couldn't actually manifest. He has the icons, he has the speeches, he has the paintings, the grand stature, but he doesn't actually have the historical track record to actually have been successful to found a country. And that's due to a lot of reasons. Like I said, there's a lot of reasons for that. And he couldn't actually manage to find a successor. So his political will kind of like died with him. So right. Then each one of the countries started, did their own thing. So just to finish up, then Colombia and Venezuela got founded, Ecuador got founded, and then the Peru and Colombia also have territorial disputes after that. Bolivia and Peru also have territorial disputes after that. And Ecuador, we inherited a lot of debt. So there was a lot of money to be owed. So after this, the Gran Colombia Project, each country is founded. Each of the country gets a military dictator, well, not dictator, a military president. And most of them serve like 30 or 40 years. Santander, he dies young, so he left the presidency to another guy, but he also served like a couple of terms. Páez also did that, and then he got the throne and then came back. Flores also served 3 terms as presidency. And then they all kind of like put the countries back together. So at the end, they kind of managed to do it. But at the end, they were politically effective, but they were not transcendent. And they were not iconic. They were good administrators, or at least good military generals, or at least good presidents enough to maintain the countries together. But they lack what Bolivar had, the greater than life character, the speeches, the icons, the things. So most of them are not as remembered as Bolivar, because even though they were better in the day-to-day stuff of actually managing a country, none of them had the grand ideals, the grand ambition to be. Well, they did have ambition, but not that great.
That sort of leads me on to the second question that I wanted to ask is, how is it remembered today in the countries that formed Gran Colombia?
And there you have like 2 camps. The camp of the history buff, like us, or like the hypothetical thinkers of history that says that said, well, what would have happened if, for example, Bolivar was more effective, or his alliances were great, or if he had just had a little bit more of technological advancement, like 30 or 40 years later with a telegraph or something, that could have actually sustained the countries together. So by the history buffs, by the aristocratic classes, is remembered kind of like with a little bit of somberness, like, damn, we could have been great. Damn, we could have had a lot of international power. We could have been like a transatlantic, the Caribbean could have had ours, basically, Cuba and Haiti, and we could have projected ourselves in the history throughout the seas and have our own identity and be great economically. If, for example, specifically Ecuador and Venezuela, a century later, we got oil. So can you imagine having, if Gran Colombia stayed together and then we managed to get the oil that we currently have? Both Ecuador and Colombia have, Ecuador, Colombia, and Venezuela have major oil reserves. So we could have been basically like a Saudi Arabia, like a ridiculous amount of money could have gone in if we got the economics of oil into the mix. But it couldn't happen. History wasn't there. Technology wasn't there. So history buff are kind of like sad about it. But the general populace, each of us learns that history of Gran Colombia as primary school teaching. But most of the general populace, like I said, the disconnection between the aristocracy and the lower class people is that for most of us, it was like Bolivar's thing. And we respect him as our founder, leader, and things. But then immediately after the Gran Colombia subjects teach, each of us learn why our countries were founded. And now we focus on, for Venezuelans, it's Páez. for Colombians is Santander, and for Peruvian, for Ecuadorian is Flores, and then each of them gets to learn why their own respective leaders decided to separate. And they had all the reasons to it. And then they had all the legal and political and economic reasons to separate. And then most of us don't remember Gran Colombia as a grand thing. So if you ask the average Latin American citizen, they might know about it and they might tell you, well, it was kind of like an interesting time. It was at the end of the war, but it was never going to work. So it's not really nostalgic for it. So like I said, since after the unity never actually manifested the identity, each Latin American country gets their own national identity. Yeah. So Venezuelans, Colombians, and Ecuadorians, people from Panama, Peru, and Bolivia, each of them starts to create their own national identity, their myth, their founding myth, their icons, their own flag, their own national anthem. And they, like I said, you can see it today in football. Each of our teams are highly competitive. And we take
with your everyone's very proud with their yellow football shirts.
Yes, everyone is super proud. That's
what I love, though. When I was in Colombia a couple of years ago, on match days, the whole country is wearing their yellow football shirt. It's very endearing. I thought it was very sweet.
It's very, very nice, actually. It creates like a really powerful feeling.
It does.
In Venezuela, we have our shirt for our team. And we do the same things. And we, of course, it's football. It's more tribal and rivalry, but you can see the trace. Right? Better than war, obviously. We never actually fought that many wars within each other. It was more like an economic, political rivalry, but we didn't do the whole Germany, France thing of invading and killing each other all the time. It was like there were some territorial conflicts, but like I said, most of the inheritance for the lower common man is like yes, Gran Colombia existed, but now we have a football rivalry. That's the extent to which Gran Colombia has persisted in the general unconsciousness of all of us.
I think that leads us nicely to a close. It's been super interesting talking about this. It's something that I've been interested in for a while now. So I really appreciate you coming on here, Eliezer, and engaging with me on this topic. So yeah, thank you for all your input. And yeah. Is there anything more that you'd like to say before we finish up?
Before finishing, I would like to say that I think that it's good that there's episodes on this, because I think there are a lot of parts of the world that get overlooked with their interesting history, Latin America being one of them, Southeast Asia also, or Far East Asia, or big parts of Africa. There are a lot of really interesting history and characters, and like I said, there ought to be more like podcasts or episodes or even movies or series about these characters, because they're really important to our people, but to each of the people that is interested in history. Just like I read Napoleon, I think French people also need to read about Bolivar, because they're kind of like parallels to each other that did a lot of things in common. So there are a lot of things that history can teach us from the other people's perspective that lead us to be more in tune even with our own society and our own history. And we understand we have these weird connections that we didn't know we had, but we actually did.
Yeah, exactly. No, and that's why I want to do these sorts of episodes. I don't want to be too Eurocentric. So thank you for helping me be less Eurocentric. Because as you say, the history in every part of the world is equally as interesting. So thank you for helping me explore the topic, this very interesting topic of Gran Colombia. And please do join me again soon for talking about another topic. Thank you so much, Eliezer.
Yes, you're welcome. I will be glad to do another topic.
Wonderful. Okay, well, thank you very much for listening, everyone, and see you next time. Bye. Hi, guys. Just a quick heads up. This episode was shortened to fit within the time limit. If you'd like to catch the full length version and even watch the video, head over to the History Buff Patreon page. Your support means the world to me. Until next time, take care and stay tuned for more exclusive content on Patreon. Cheers.